When Sarah Scholes was working as a public outreach officer at the Green Bank Radio Telescope, she found herself shuttling around a group of scientists involved in SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. One of them left her purse on the bus. It was Jill Tarter's. Returning that purse to one of her scientific heroes led eventually to a biography. Find out all about this inspiring and at times sad story of scientific grit. Coming up next. It's all new and all blue. Join us. Jill Tarter recently retired as the leader of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. Her career as a radio astronomer searching for signals from alien civilizations was a major inspiration for the character of Ellie Arroway, played by Jodie Foster in the 1997 film Contact. That character, based on the book by Carl Sagan, influenced a generation of young women to pursue careers in astronomy and science. One of them was Sarah Scholes. Her work as a science writer has appeared in Wired, The Smithsonian, Slate, The Washington Post, Scientific American, and Popular Science. She also served as an editor for Astronomy Magazine, before turning her full attention to writing a biography of one of her heroes, Jill Tarter. The result, Making Contact, Jill Tarter and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, was published by Pegasus Books earlier this year. She joined us to talk about it via Skype. Sarah Scholes, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I'd like to know how you first came into contact, to use that term, with Jill. When did you first meet her?
I first met Jill in 2010 when I was working at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is in Green Bank, West Virginia. And it was the first place that anyone ever performed a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And so the people at this observatory were holding a conference to commemorate the 50th anniversary of that very first search. And of course, Jill Tarter was attending this event, and I had only been working at my job for about a month, and so I didn't really know how to do anything yet that was useful. So my boss asked me to drive a bus of all these very important SETI people down to the telescope so they could eat dessert and do some stargazing and things like that. And I did that. And when I drove them back, Jill Tarter left her purse on the bus, and I picked it up and looked at the driver's license, and it said Jill Tarter. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have the opportunity to introduce myself to Jill Tarter and return to her something she lost. So I chased her down as she was on her way to the cocktail hour and gave her purse back to her. And that was the end of our interaction at the time.
What a serendipitous moment. And who would have thought from that you would be writing a biography?
Definitely not me at the time.
In the time from then to now, what were you doing?
Well, I worked there at the observatory for a few years, and then I took a job as an editor at Astronomy Magazine. And while I was working there, I got interested in the idea of writing a book. And as I was thinking, you know, what would I want to write a book about? I went back to the things that had first really caught my attention in astronomy, which were watching Contact, which came out when I was 12 years old, and reading the book and thinking about all these big questions. Are we alone? What else is out there? And then this important person, Jill Tarter, who is, you know, partly the basis for the main character in Contact. And those were the things that had really struck me when I was younger and kind of sent me on my path. And so I thought, you know, there was this fictional book about her and or about someone who was like her. And why not have a non-fictional book about the same thing in the actual search for extraterrestrial intelligence? And so I just sent her an email and said, I gave you back your purse and now I would like to write your biography. And
Wow. Then,
yeah, she said yes eventually. It took a little convincing, but she said yes.
Can you put Jill Tarter in perspective for our audience? Tell us about who she is as a scientist.
Yeah, well, Jill Tarter started out being a scientist who did not study extraterrestrial intelligence. She was on the path. She was studying objects called brown dwarfs when she was doing her PhD work, which are these things that are smaller than regular stars and bigger than planets. And she actually coined the term brown dwarfs. But then one day, one of her advisors who she had worked with showed her this document that NASA had produced called the Cyclops Report. And it was a look at whether humans were ready for the first time to try to search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and then kind of laying out the technology of how we would do that if we decided to do that. And she found this document and read it and just became very obsessed with the idea. She liked that it was something that regular people could connect to in a way that maybe they couldn't connect to brown dwarfs. And so after that, she started doing SETI work. She worked on NASA's very first SETI project called the High Resolution Microwave Survey, which started being in planning phases in the 1970s and then finally came into being in the early 1990s. And then since then, she has led a number of private searches for extraterrestrial intelligence through the SETI Institute. And just throughout the whole history of SETI, she's been kind of at the head, leading the charge and making sure that SETI stays alive.
And as a woman, she faced a lot of sexism. When she started her career out, she had to be like the only woman in some of her classes, right?
She did, yeah. She studied engineering physics at Cornell University, and she was the lone woman there. And at the time, she was not allowed to enter the boys' side of the dorms. The boys' dorms were on one side of campus and the girls were on the other side, and she was not allowed to go over there. So all the boys in her classes would get together and collaborate on their homework, and little Jill Tarter just had to sit alone in her room or the library doing her own work. And that was not an uncommon thing for her, to be the only woman in the room even beyond college. But I think she would probably say both that it made her stronger and maybe a better physicist, but also that she hopes that no one ever has to go through that again.
And you mentioned Contact. I think it's important for us to note that that movie's now 20 years old, which is hard to believe. And I know for my own daughter about your age, you know, for young women, when that movie came out with Jodie Foster as Ellie Arroway, and Matthew McConaughey, of course, is in that film. That film had a tremendous impact on young women your generation, didn't it?
It did, yeah, which is kind of amazing to realize. I am not an astronomer, but I have a lot of friends my own age who are astronomers, and it's amazing just the huge percentage of them who ended up choosing that as a career, in part because they saw Contact at this kind of impressionable teenage age. I remember I did an internship at the same telescope where I had my first job when I was 18, and the five or six other interns and I all got together and realized that we had come to this place to do radio astronomy specifically because we learned that radio astronomy existed from this movie, Contact. And I think it was not only that it had this very impressive woman scientist doing this very impressive thing, but that it's a sci-fi movie. They find aliens. That hasn't happened. But it's a very realistic depiction of someone that girls can imagine being, I think, which is pretty rare for a movie featuring a scientist.
And of course, a lot of people like to draw the parallels between the Ellie Arroway character and Jill Tarter. Of course, Ellie Arroway is a fictional character written by Carl Sagan, but Jill was involved in the making of the film, wasn't she?
She was. She helped Jodie Foster learn what it was to be a scientist, I think is the way she put it. They met on set at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, which you may recall from the movie, if you've seen it, is the big telescope in the jungle in Puerto Rico. And Jill Tarter was maybe ready to explain some science and astronomy to Jodie Foster. And Jodie Foster said, you know, I'm not going to teach anyone that science. That's not what anyone is going to get out of this movie. But what they might learn is what scientists are like and what it's like to be one. And so they would have these phone calls about what it was like to research these big questions. And I know that Jodie Foster once asked Jill Tarter if astronomers had egos or not, and Jill Tarter made kind of an inside joke, which is that only the infrared astronomers have egos, and of course, Jill Tarter is a radio astronomer. But
And one of the threads in the book that also parallels the Ellie Arroway character in Contact is running up against the scientific establishment and the government You know, and people in Congress that are funding research, even though it's not a lot of money, that try to characterize this somehow as some wild search for UFOs or something like that. She really had to run up against a lot of difficulties in keeping funding alive for SETI.
Yeah, and that part of the movie is very true to real life. SETI's political problems really started when a senator named Richard Bryanford from Nevada gave them what he called a Golden Fleece Award, which he gave to projects that he thought were wasting taxpayer money. And he had this attitude about the project that, you know, there's so many problems here on Earth. Why are we spending these millions of dollars looking for aliens when we could be, you know, building better schools in Detroit or things like that? And so he gave them this award, and actually Carl Sagan helped convince him that maybe SETI was a good thing and could help give us all some cosmic perspective and get along better. But then problems kept cropping up with politicians who did not like this search for little green men. And actually a year after NASA started its SETI project, almost a year to the day, Congress canceled it and said that there could be no more federal funding of SETI projects because it was just too out there and too much of a waste.
Yeah, and wasn't that William Proxmire and the Golden Fleece Award?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I said Richard Bryan before, and I meant, yes, Proxmire, yes.
Yeah, I remember that. And so she had to go a different way, didn't she?
She did. She and scientists at the SETI Institute, right after that congressional termination, sat down the very next Monday and tried to learn all about fundraising, because they knew if they weren't going to be getting these federal science funds, they were going to have to convince wealthy people of the world that SETI was an okay thing to fund and that they should put their money towards it. And so they started approaching the early founders of Silicon Valley, like the founders of Hewlett and Packard, and Paul Allen of Microsoft and people like that, and convincing these philanthropists to put their money toward the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And that is the way that most of SETI has been funded since 1993.
Let's talk a bit about the Hat Creek Radio Observatory and the Allen Telescope Array, because, you know, that was supposed to be this, you know, 350-dish array of small radio telescopes that was going to be the next great thing in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And it's really had kind of a tortured journey to where it is now. Could you just give us a brief overview of that?
Sure. Yeah, the Allen Telescope Array, it was initially envisioned as this world-class telescope that would be dedicated to SETI, and kind of came out of NASA's very earliest study, Project Cyclops, which I mentioned before about how we could go about searching for aliens. And because it happened after Congress terminated all funding, it was a totally privately funded thing, and most of the initial money came from a man named Paul Allen, who was a co-founder of Microsoft, and they were going to build, like you said, these 350 antennas. But I mean, like a lot of engineering projects, the research and development took a lot longer than was expected and cost more than was expected. And so with the funds that they had, they were actually only able to build 42 antennas instead of 350, which is a pretty big difference. And so it's not as sensitive as they had hoped. It's not as world-class as they had hoped. And it also used to be a part of the University of California, Berkeley, and they had to split off during the financial crisis. So it's had a lot of ups and downs, but it is still searching for aliens in the way that it can at this very moment. And it is in the middle of a pretty big upgrade that should make what's there twice as sensitive as it was before, even if it's not quite as big as they planned.
That's great to hear, because it's in my backyard just behind Lassen Volcanic National Park.
It's a beautiful telescope and they take visitors. So if people want to go see it.
It's pretty neat up there. Just that whole area is beautiful. A friend of mine who's a geology buff, he wanted to come up and see LASS, and I said, well, make sure you go see the Hat Creek area, because, and he found that to be almost as fascinating as Lassen Park.
Yeah, absolutely. And an interesting thing about telescopes in general, I think, and radio telescopes in particular, is that they're pretty remote. And so they're just these very technological things that are all about electronics, Just sitting in the middle of nowhere, like sometimes you find cows next to the Allen Telescope Array, and like you said, it's right next to Lassen, and it's just an interesting contrast to me.
It's a stark and beautiful place. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom. After a short break, we'll continue my interview with Sarah Scholes, author of Making Contact, Jill Tarter and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's resume my conversation with science writer Sarah Scholes. Her new book, Making Contact, explores the life and career of SETI pioneer Jill Tarter. Tarter recently retired from the SETI Institute, but is still actively working on behalf of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. One of the recent developments has been this argument back and forth, a debate about passive versus active SETI. In other words, just listen for signals versus sending a signal out. Could you just briefly talk a bit about, you know, Jill's position on that?
Sure. Jill Tarter herself is kind of the opinion that if we are going to start sending messages out into the universe and hoping to attract alien attention, then we should be prepared to do it for a really long time. She uses the number 10,000 years because, you know, what is the chance that a given alien civilization is listening to us right exactly at this moment? And so to be effective, it just has to be a really long-term thing. And then on the other side are people who would like to do it right now, this instant, immediately, no matter what happens next. And then there are people, most notably, I think, Stephen Hawking, who think that we should keep very quiet because maybe the aliens are mean and would like to conquer us and we should not let them know that we are here.
Well, if you look at human beings as any example, whenever we have encountered a species below us or a culture below us, things haven't gone too well. So I can understand all those points of view.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so what's now, Jill is retired, right?
She is. She retired in 2012.
And she's retired like my brother-in-law is retired from Cal Fire, because I think he's out driving a water tender on a fire right now.
Right. Yeah. Jill is driving her own version of that right now. She, as far as I can tell, she is mostly always working, even in retirement. I think she works more than me still.
And what's like the latest big thing in SETI?
I actually just learned about, and this is a thing that isn't in the book because I myself just learned about it. The SETI Institute is kind of getting on board with the idea of looking for lasers, alien lasers, that send out really bright, very short pulses of visible light that could outshine our sun just for a really brief instant. And this is something that other groups have been doing. And now I think Jill is excited that they are getting more on board with doing that in-house at the SETI Institute, because they've spent a long time doing radio, which gets some amount of criticism because what are the chances that aliens are using radio to communicate? And I mean, truly, what are the chances they're using lasers to communicate? We really have no idea. But I think that she is excited at the new diversity of options.
Well, paralleling SETI in something that NASA is very involved with is just the search for life beyond Earth, because, you know, there's one, you know, it's one thing to look for intelligent life, civilizations out there in our galaxy, which there may or may not be. But the other thing is their life. And we've really come to a revolutionary time. And in your book, you talk about, you know, the extremophiles and exoplanets revolution.
Yeah, when SETI first started, no one knew if there were planets at all, you know, if aliens would have any place to live. We could have been the only solar system out there. But just in the past, really just the past few years, we've discovered exactly how many planets are out there, which is more, there are more planets in our galaxy than there are stars. And a lot of them are probably in pretty good places where maybe not where we exactly could live, but where something could live. And that has been a huge shift in the way that people think about things. And it came at the same time that people were discovering, you know, organisms on Earth that can live at the very bottom of the ocean or in the pools of nuclear reactors or just in very places that we ourselves would find very inhospitable. And so all of that combined has really given this field called astrobiology, which is searching for life that is not necessarily intelligent. It could be just microbes of some sort, a little more cultural cachet. And we have and are soon to have telescopes that can look for the chemicals in the atmospheres of other planets that might tell us if this kind of life does exist. So it's not really sci-fi at all. We can have some, not totally definitive, but kind of definitive answers about what might be out there on a pretty short time scale.
Tantalizing indications that there is life beyond Earth. What's your personal feeling about that?
Well, I mean, I don't know because I can't see all of the universe, and I like to try to think like scientists and not fully have an opinion until the evidence comes in. But I think that a universe without life in it makes less sense to me than one that has life in it. You know, the universe is just so big. It has so many planets. Life can live in so many places. It would seem almost absurd if there was nothing else out there.
Why don't you go with the Ellie Arroway quote?
If we're the only ones out there, it seems like an awful waste of space. That one?
Yes, that's the one. That's a good one.
What do you think?
I feel the same way you do. I just think that the universe is so vast, and the time spans are so far beyond what most of us are able to comprehend, that it doesn't make sense to me that there isn't life beyond Earth. Now, whether that life develops into technological civilizations or just intelligence, that's another thing. And like, you know, just have to wait and see. One of the things I always think about is there could be intelligent life out there, but they may not have technology. Look at whales and dolphins in our oceans. They have no way to use opposable fingers and thumbs to adapt to technology to their needs to make things. But they are intelligent communicating beings, and there could be things like that all over the galaxy that we would have no way of detecting them.
Yeah, absolutely. And who's even to say that intelligence necessarily means having an impulse to find out what else is out there? There could be very smart whale aliens who never think about whether there's life outside of them.
And you know, we're all so conditioned from Hollywood films to think they look like, you know, they always look too much like something that we've seen on Earth, like insects or something bipedal with two arms and two legs. And who knows if there is life beyond Earth, we may not even recognize it as being alive.
Right. Yeah. Our movies, while creative, have probably not been creative enough.
Yeah. I think it was Arthur C. Clarke that said something to the effect that the universe, you know, is probably far stranger than we can imagine.
Yeah, I think that that is probably very true.
What's one of the things that I found a little difficult reading in your book, because I do care about your subject matter. I think as you develop empathy for your subject, and I know these people, is as we get older, you know, Jill seems to be concerned about, you know, especially as a scientist, but I think all of us feel the same way about, you know, your loss of your physical body's youth and memory. And you comment on that quite a bit in the book.
Yeah, I think that's something that makes writing a biography of someone who is living very different from someone who is in the past, is that you're seeing them reflect on their own life as it's going on. And it was, I mean, strange for me, and I'm sure strange for Jill herself to hear her talk about things like losing memory, or she can't remember names and dates as well as she used to. Don't get me wrong, she's very with it, but it was very interesting to hear someone, muse on their own mortality and then kind of be in charge of presenting that to the public. And especially for someone like Jill, who is so entrenched in this, cosmic perspective of humans are just a blip and the universe is so big, and to know that she still, cares about her own life and doesn't think of that as insignificant enough not to care about things like, not being able to climb a mountain as fast as she used to.
And there is something a bit depressing, if I can put it that way, about you dedicate your life searching for a signal from extraterrestrial intelligence, and as of today, as far as I know, we haven't found any, and that's got to be difficult. And you also portray that quite well.
Thank you. It's a hard thing to write a book about a subject that doesn't really have a climax. It would have been, great for the narrative if they had found aliens. But I think the way people think about SETI now is maybe different from when they very first started, because before anyone had done very much searching, it seemed or could have seemed a lot more likely that they would discover something tomorrow. If no one had searched, you never know what you'll find. It could be out there right now. And now that it's been a little over a half century, the chances that it will be tomorrow seem slimmer if it hasn't happened already. And I think that that is something Jill has had to come to terms with, especially after she retired. And I think the way that she did it was thinking about what SETI the search can add to people's lives rather than what SETI the answer can add to people's lives. And that goes back to what she calls the cosmic perspective of putting yourself in the place of the universe, this big, long, old place, and thinking about what a blip you are, and then thinking about how much the same that makes everyone on Earth compared to whatever else is out there. And she's become very invested later in life in portraying that to the public, I think.
I appreciate your time. It was really fun to talk to you about this, Sarah, and best of luck with the book, Making Contact, Jill Tarter and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to science writer Sarah Scholes. Her new book, Making Contact, Jill Tarter and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, was published by Pegasus Books earlier this summer. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org, subscribe on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Follow us on Twitter at @NSPRNews or me at Dave Schlom. Blue Dot is co-produced and engineered by Nolan Ford on the board. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, was composed and performed by Matt Schiltz of New York City. For all of us here, we remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.